Today on Against the Grain, modern police forces rose to power through sexual policing, contends today's guest. So what is sexual policing, and how have its targets changed over time? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with the historian Anne Gray Fisher coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The police don't target just anyone. They don't surveil, harass, or arrest all lawbreakers. They choose, with the help of legislatures and courts, who to go after and on what basis. And their choices have changed over time, including with respect to women presumed to engage in criminalized sexual activity. So what's the significance of these choices and the shifts in who police target? And what does this have to do with police power, with the legitimization of police authority and police violence? A book by Anne Gray Fisher has the title, The Streets Belong to Us, Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. Annie is assistant professor of history at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her research explores histories of gender, sexuality, and race, law enforcement and the state, and feminist activisms in the modern U.S. When Annie and I connected recently, I asked what motivated her to investigate the set of topics that her book addresses.
So I first started to think about the history of prostitution policing while I was working at a labor union local in Boston in the mid-2000s. My boss had a framed poster on his wall of PUMA, the Prostitutes Union of Massachusetts, from the 1970s. And I was just really captivated by the idea of a group of criminalized women organizing for labor rights, right, as sex workers. I didn't yet know that there was a rich history nationwide of sex workers organizing, starting, of course, with Margo St. James's Coyote, Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics, which she launched on Mother's Day in 1973, and which spread across the country, inspiring lots of other organizations like PUMA. So that was really what started my interest in these questions of sex worker autonomy and sex worker resistance.
Sexual policing is the focus of your book. How do you define sexual policing?
So while the book is really looking at prostitution law enforcement, right? The enforcement of prostitution misdemeanors and prostitution-related misdemeanors, which include disorderly conduct, lewd and lascivious conduct, all sorts of these sort of broad public order misdemeanors. But I define it as really any kind of law enforcement that focuses on targeting and policing people's bodies and their presumed sexual behaviors. I focus on this sort of broad definition of sexual policing because the laws themselves are very broad, very vague, and across the 20th century, there really was no legal distinction between promiscuity, right, the presumption of a woman having sex with multiple partners, and prostitution, right, the commercial exchange of sex for cash or other goods. So really, I follow the way that these laws are enforced, which is broad, which is discretionary, and which is focusing on presumed behaviors rather than actual actions and sexual practices.
And what is the racial or racialized focus of your book? What are you trying to say, not just about the policing of women, but about the policing of certain women?
When I started thinking about the history of sex work and prostitution law enforcement, sexual policing, many people, from the sex workers themselves to even folks involved in law enforcement and cops, they all said something along the same lines that prostitution is the oldest profession. Prostitution is sort of this unchanging constant. And I'm a historian, and I really thought that that was something that was available to be interrogated, examined, and thought through. So I really came to this project fresh and think about what has changed over time with the enforcement of prostitution laws in the U.S. across the 20th century. And I found several different changes that I track over time in the book, but the racial piece was really surprising to me. I think especially for folks who are used to seeing this media saturation and these sort of controlling tropes, controlling narratives of Black women engaged in commercial sex. There is a thought, and we also have Black feminist historians documenting the ways in which Black women have been disproportionately targeted for sexual policing across the 20th century, right? Pretty much since emancipation. But what I found was that while, yes, there is absolutely a racist, selective enforcement of prostitution laws targeting Black women across the long 20th century, if you look closer at the statistics, we see a change in racial priorities in sexual policing across the long 20th century that can tell us something bigger about how police gain power over time and how cities have been developed across the long 20th century.
Well, that suggests that there's been some sort of a shift in the last century or so in the targets of police in terms of presumed sexual activity, in terms of the types of women, racially speaking, that they are going after. Is that right?
So I think we need to understand two police practices that we're seeing over time. So while, yes, Black women have been identified as lawless, sexually deviant, and sexually criminal city residents since the early 20th century, we also see a deeply rooted practice of police neglect, right? We also see the ways in which police are not concerned with Black women's sexual practices, Black women's presumed sexual deviance, because it wasn't presumed to be a threat to a dominant urban order, moral order, in the earlier part of the 20th century. So what I found when I went back and looked at the archives of moral reformers, politicians, urban authorities, and police departments in the early 20th century, what I found was an overwhelming obsession, a preoccupation with white women's sexual morality, sexual purity, right? And this was really the charge for police departments in cities in the early 20th century, was to enforce the purity of white womanhood. This changes across the 20th century when instead of a driving focus being about the enforcement of white women's sexual purity, there is a transition in the middle of the 20th century to a hyper-criminalization and a driving preoccupation with the presumed sexual criminality of Black women. There are statistics, right, that confirm this overarching trend. And I just want to be clear that while I have some police statistics that I work with and think through, you know, I'm not working with police statistics as some measure of truth about or any sort of criminological fact, but rather arrest statistics can show us very clearly police priorities and practices. And this book is very much about exposing the structural trends that we see in police departments across the 20th century. So in the early 1930s, when the FBI started collecting arrest statistics for these sexual order misdemeanors, right? Prostitution and prostitution-related misdemeanors. We see that across that period from the 1930s to the early 2020s, the proportion of Black people arrested for sexual crimes doubled, while white people's arrests dropped by a third, right? And that really tells us a story about the gradual decriminalization of white women's sexual practices over time, bound up with, interconnected, inseparable from the gathering storm of sexual criminalization, the rising, skyrocketing arrest rates of Black women on sexual charges.
That's the voice of Anne Gray Fisher, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Texas at Dallas. We are talking about her book, The Streets Belong to Us: Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Annie, if the focus in the early 20th century was more on safeguarding the sexual purity of white womanhood, and you identify those women as largely working class white and European immigrant women, what were seen, who was seen as the threats to this sexual purity? Was there a racial component to this?
During the early 20th century, there is a moral panic around the increasing autonomy and independence of poor and working white women on city streets. These women were identified as a major threat to urban order, living unchaperoned, living independent lives. This was in itself a major concern for women moral reformers, for urban authorities. It was widely known as the girl problem, right? What to do with all these young working women who were making their own wages, right? Often living together without men. And they were seen as a destabilizing force in a urban order that had been built around domestic, dependent womanhood, right? Living in homes headed by men who were husbands, fathers, or brothers, right? And so this was a major cause for concern. Listeners of the show might be familiar with the moral panic around so-called white slavery during this period. White slavery was a source of sensational print culture, and even the emerging film industry would narrate stories of young white women being kidnapped or captured, usually by men of color or Jewish men, right, who were then sold into sexual slavery. Many historians have written about this moment. Jessica Plyley in Policing Sexuality, I think, writes beautifully about this history. But really, white slavery shows its racial priorities, its racial investments on its face, right? This was about the endangerment of white women. But just as white women were framed as endangered, vulnerable to sexual predators, and of course the racial component comes through clearly, we also know that during this time there is a terrifying reign of lynch terror happening across the U.S., where Black men in particular were framed as key sexual predators and threats to white women. But what we also see when we look at police records, police archives, the records of private investigators, private moral reform investigators who deputized themselves to go undercover in bars and nightclubs and restaurants in cities all over the U.S. to quote unquote investigate sexual disorder or sexual crimes and then send along everything that they found to police departments to pressure them to take action. What we see when we look at these records is that women were being targeted themselves, and in very intensive campaigns evidenced by high arrest rates, that young women who were out on city streets without a male chaperone or out with men of color in social situations white women who were out with men who were not even if they were out with white men, if those men were not their husbands, brothers, or relative or fathers, then they were treated by police with a very high degree of suspicion, and many were arrested. They would be arrested on prostitution-related misdemeanors, but there would be no evidence at all of any exchange of sex for cash.
If the presumed sexual practices of white women were the focus of law enforcement in the early 1900s, how were black women, and your focus in this book is black women on city streets, how were they viewed back then such that they did not attract perhaps the same level of attention from the police as white women?
So one of my key arguments, right, is that the enforcement of white women's sexual purity, right, the enforcement of laws targeting and regulating white women's behaviors on city streets was a key element to enforcing racial segregation. By the 1920s, we have a situation where the former red light districts of the late 19th century have been relocated to black neighborhoods. Right. And this signaled that black neighborhoods, you know, sites where black residents lived, worked, played, right, were at leisure in their communities. These sites were then naturalized through police action as sites of sexual lawbreaking, deviance, and criminality. As a result, black women on city streets in their own neighborhoods would become neglected by police, while also treated by police as presumptive sex workers. When police would target and enforce any interracial relationship they saw, they would also make sure to keep white women out of black neighborhoods, right, and to really set the boundaries of segregation through sexual policing, right, by sorting who belongs where in a city, right? Sexual policing was a powerful tool to establish and set these racial boundaries. And then inside black neighborhoods, right, which were increasingly fortified by police as sites of permitted vice, white men would stream through for entertainment, for the nightlife, right, and to engage in commercial sex. So what black women were really confronting in their own neighborhoods was both police neglect, as police looked away, right, from any kind of nightlife or commercial sex or gambling that took place in black neighborhoods, right? So black neighborhoods were sort of established by police as zones of vice. So black women were neglected, even as they would be hyper vulnerable to a raid if the winds of political outrage or a fresh wave of moral panic pressured police to, quote, take action by racking up hundreds of arrests at a time in a city.
Right, and you call this distinct form of state harm, you call this violent neglect. Could you elaborate more on what you mean by that?
One of my key arguments, right, is that police produce violence not only in the work that they're doing, but through their neglect as well. And in the early 20th century, there's one excellent example that I spotlight in the book of Eva Bolden. Eva Bolden was a resident in a black neighborhood in Pittsburgh. And one night she was terrified to be awakened when five white men had broken into her apartment. They claimed that they were looking for, quote, a house of prostitution. Eva Bolden and her husband Ike, who then was also awakened, armed themselves with whatever they had available in their apartment. So Eva Bolden grabbed a knife while her husband grabbed a chair. And they were defending themselves against these white men. When the police were brought to the Boldens' home, it was Ike and Eva Bolden who were arrested for attempted aggravated assault and not the white men, right? Because the white men, it was presumed, were perfectly legitimate in their search for a, quote, house of prostitution in a black neighborhood. And so Ike and Eva Bolden's efforts, right, to defend their own home, to defend each other against these five marauding white men became framed as a criminal act, right? And I think that's a perfect illustration of how black women were rendered profoundly vulnerable to non-state violence by the white men who had broken into her home, right? It was justified through the naturalization of black criminality and sexual deviance, which was enforced by police actions.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Annie Gray Fisher is an historian based at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her research and teaching explore histories of gender, sexuality, and race, law enforcement and the state, and feminist activisms in the modern U.S. We are talking about her book, The Streets Belong to Us, Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. So you cite as kind of the key period in terms of the sexual policing of white women becoming a lower law enforcement priority as the 1970s and 1980s, to some degree the 1960s. But before we get to the 1960s, I want to ask you about the post-war years and what happened to extramarital sex rates or frequency of extramarital sex among middle-class white women in those post-war years and how society or law enforcement agencies responded to that.
So I was shocked to find a social science research report in the archive from New Orleans in 1964. It was sort of this two-lane criminology report from the mid-1960s that found that policemen were not offended by sexual behaviors, unconventional sexual behaviors of black women, and was more offended, right, more outraged when they saw sort of deviations from traditional or normative sexual practices in white women, right? So as late as 1964, police officers were sort of expecting to see what they considered to be sexual criminality in black women, and they were outraged when they would see it in white women. So there was this double standard where white women, the purity was the priority for police through the mid-1960s, right? And black women were sort of expected to be deviant, expected to be sexually criminal through the 1960s. The post-war period is an important hinge moment because increasingly the behaviors that white women had been targeted by police for were increasingly recognized as normative sexual behaviors of all women, all kinds of women across the U.S., right? The Kinsey reports in the post-war period showcased for Americans how often sex was happening outside the bounds of wedlock, right? All of a sudden, after Kinsey, more and more people realized that people are having all kinds of sex that would be technically illegal. So what they discovered was that there was this whole generation of women, and particularly white women, who were categorized as quote-unquote law-abiding lawbreakers. So what you start to see among liberal lawyers, legal scholars, even some liberal prosecutors and judges, you're seeing this sort of massing movement to relax extremely retrograde criminal laws, which are criminalizing kind of the vast majority of people's sexual practices throughout the 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, talk about the kind of the disparate racial impact, if you will, of these decisions to change laws, to challenge morals laws on the books. And there's also an In Re Lane decision you point to in your book. It was a California Supreme Court decision that struck down, as I understand it, Los Angeles's municipal morals ordinances, or at least a number of them.
Yes. So the book, we've been talking pretty broadly, pretty national level up until now. And I will say that half of the book looks at sexual policing practices across the 20th century in cities nationwide. And then half of the book has one chapter each focusing on three different cities to really ground the story and what's happening in the distinct context of Los Angeles for the 1950s and 60s, Boston in the 70s, and Atlanta in the 80s. So that I can show how these post-war changes are really taking place on the ground. So I look at the story of the liberalization of sex laws, the relaxation of sex laws, which really made any kind of sex outside of marriage illegal. I look at that story as it plays out in Los Angeles, with some high-level, state-level courts in California. What we basically find is that when the courts, particularly the Supreme Court of California, strike down laws criminalizing sex between unmarried women and men, when unmarried women have sex, the Supreme Court of California struck down that law as unconstitutional, right? As an overreach, as too vague, as criminalizing acts that were already found to be legal at the state level. So what would happen then, right? What do police do in that case when all of a sudden sex between two consenting adults, unmarried adults, is now legal? This would actually be a major blow to police authority, police legitimacy. It was a major loss of their power. And in fact, police did howl in protest at the ways that courts were taking away their power to police women's bodies on city streets. And that is also sort of a second argument. I have this racial change over time piece in the book, but a key argument as well is that sexual policing is crucial to police legitimacy and police consolidation of power. It's really, really important to cops that they can surveil and target people based on their bodies, based on their presumed sexual behaviors. That is very, very important for police to establish power on city streets.
So in other words, what you're saying, Annie, is that, you know, because there's a lot of talk about the expansion of police power over time. So are you saying, Annie, that this expansion, this growth of police power cannot be understood without grasping the nature and extent of sexual policing over time?
Absolutely. When my book opens, after the scandalous failure of prohibition, police were widely seen as unqualified to engage in any kind of morals policing. What Americans saw throughout Prohibition was that police were lawless, they were brutal, and that they were extremely corrupt, right? And so by the time that my book opens in the early 20th century, police were widely regarded as quote-unquote a national joke. No self-respecting officer wanted to engage in any kind of morals enforcement or moral order enforcement because it was so brutal. It was widely regarded as a major source of police corruption. And it is in fact true that prostitution laws and prostitution-related misdemeanors are written with such a high degree of overbreadth and vagueness, that they really are impossible to fully enforce. And so police enforce with a very high degree of discretion, right? They make choices based on their context, based on the ideological context in which they work and based on the political context in which they work, also based on the political economy of the city in which they work, right? It's all structures, their discretionary practices, which I track over time. And what I find is that after the failure of prohibition, police want to get sexual policing back. They want it to legitimize their work. And they want to maintain that authority over policing the bodies of people that they encounter on city streets. As one scholar in the 1980s, an economics scholar actually of prostitution in the 1980s, said that police seem to feel powerless without the authority to enforce prostitution-related laws. So it is very, it's central to police authority to monitor, to surveil, and to target people based on their appearances. And so what you see across the 20th century is the police fight to maintain control over sexual policing, to justify their work as either valuable for the order and morality of a city, or later in the second half of the 20th century as profitable for cities, right? Or it's sort of the only solution for profitable booming cities, right? So they find different strategies to justify sexual policing in order to legitimize their own power.
That's Anne Gray Fisher, assistant professor of history at the University of Texas at Dallas. On our website, againsttothegrain.org, we have a link to her book, The Streets Belong to Us: Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So let's get back to what you were saying about L.A. in the 60s. We have these rulings and this legislation that seems to take away some of that discretion that the police could use when enforcing vagrancy and disorderly conduct and anti-prostitution laws. So what did the police do? How did they respond to what they saw as an attack on their powers?
After the Supreme Court of California struck down Morrill's misdemeanors that criminalized non-marital sex, non-marital straight sex, the chief of police at the time, William Parker, sort of a notorious figure in the early 1960s, lashed out, called the ruling a prostitute's bill of rights. There was also during the same period in the early 1960s, a California legislature passed a law that tried to take away some of the discretionary power of police to make arrests based on vagrancy charges, right? So basically what these sort of liberal courts and legislatures were trying to do was take away the police power to enforce morals laws with a high degree of discretion or selective enforcement, and to give individuals, you know, more rights to not be policed based on how they look. But this was all taking place, right, not in a vacuum, but in a very real city in Los Angeles, where residential racial segregation was intense and acute, right, where Black residents lived in 9 neighborhoods, right, crammed into 9 neighborhoods in a city of at least 30 in the 50s and early 60s, where also, of course, many white families are decamping to the suburbs to take advantage of racist housing subsidies, particularly for returning vets. So what you have is the development of hyper-segregation in Los Angeles. And so what you really see happen is that increasingly sexual policing takes 2 tracks, right? Where white women who are targeted as sexually deviant or sexual problems, they are identified as having psychological or pathological disorders, right, and maybe in need of psychiatric treatment, but certainly not jail. Whereas for Black residents, for Black women, they are identified and targeted by police as a criminal problem. And you see this really come through in very stark numbers in the arrests, which again are not a measure of criminality, of course, or of criminological fact, but are rather a measure of police practices. And what we see is that in the years between 1954 and 1963, these were just the years available, we can see that white women's prostitution-related arrests drop by over 20%, while Black women's arrests rise by 20%. Black residents on the ground in Los Angeles were fully aware that something was happening in the changes in sexual policing practices, right? You have in black newspapers, you have columnists, editorials, reports on the ways in which Black women in particular continued to be targeted for sexual policing, even as increasingly white women in Hollywood or other sort of, or other white neighborhoods that were also sites of nightlife, where, you know, they were walking more freely from police intervention.
Yeah, and this led, and you lay this out in your book, to resistance. And your book is, a large part of it is about resistance to selective or discriminatory sexual policing. There were protests, there were confrontations, and part of that you see is the lead up to the Watts Uprising of 1965 in Los Angeles involved days of armed struggle, dozens of people killed, mostly by police, and something like 4,000 arrests. And where I'd like to go now, since I'm thinking about the time, is to how what you're talking about relates to what happened in the 70s and 80s with the growing focus, the shift, the pronounced shift toward the targeting of Black women. What more do you want to say about the culmination of that shift, perhaps, or the fundamental features of the shift from white to Black?
Right. So after the Los Angeles chapter, right, which closes with, as you know, Black residents rising up, attempting to stop prostitution arrests by police on Black women, fighting back. You have increasing scenes of Black residents mobilizing when Black women are targeted by police on presumed sexual charges. And that builds up to a series of clashes the year prior to Watts between Black residents and police, where one of the first grievances they list, right, during this weekend of uprisings, where police and residents clash in a series of confrontations, the first grievance that many Black leaders listed during this period in the early 1960s was the discriminatory and unequal enforcement of prostitution laws, targeting Black women in particular. So after that period, right, for the LAPD and then for police departments around the US, they start to see how sexual policing can be a useful form of containing Blackness and containing Black people in particular. You know, because after Watts and after the uprisings nationwide, even though racist policing and police brutality were the clear drivers of Black resistance here, you see how urban authorities double down on policing as a way to contain Blackness in the cities. So after that period, what we then see is, you know, what historians have called a reckoning with an urban crisis, right? That urban crisis being white divestment from cities, you know, white decamping to suburbs, right? And you see cities becoming Blacker. This was particularly true in Boston and, of course, you know, certainly true in Atlanta, the next two cities that I profile in the book. So the salient driver in this sort of post-1960s moment of police department policy is how to bring money back to cities, right? And how to make cities sort of safe for white capital again. And here again, prostitution, policing, and the vilification, the criminalization of Black women as sort of uniquely dangerous to urban capital and to our cities themselves becomes this really powerful justification for police to double down on sexual policing.
Anne Gray Fisher is my guest. She teaches history at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about her book, The Streets Belong to Us, Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. How would you define broken windows policing, and how did it contribute to the targeting of Black women via sexual policing practices?
Yes. So the question for police departments in the late 60s and early 70s was how to implement these policies of mass arrest, right? That they wanted to consolidate their power, that they wanted to establish their power on city streets. How could they arrest more and more people, especially Black people, poor Black folks? How could they arrest more people even as the laws are continuing to be liberalized, right? By 1972, sort of building on the legal shifts that we saw in the California and the Los Angeles period, right, when non-marital sex is decriminalized, right, even as by 1972, vagrancy law itself is struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So then the question for police and sort of allied criminologists who want to impose more policing on city streets is how to do that legally, right? And this is the period when you start to see new techniques to justify policing people based on how they look, not how they act. This is a key front for sexual policing. And sexual policing serves as a laboratory for these legal architects to think about and to come up with strategies to make status policing or just policing people based on how they look constitutional. Broken windows policing becomes the criminological concept, this extremely influential criminological concept to justify mass low-level misdemeanor policing. It comes from James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, right? And the argument is basically that the most important policing happens for low-level offenses, right? So the idea is that a broken window contributes to the decay, the decline, the economic degradation of a neighborhood, right? And so in order to make neighborhoods safe and profitable, order matters, right? And broken windows were collapsed with all sorts of people identified by Wilson and Kelling as quote unquote disorderly. So this would include, you know, people experiencing mental illness or people experiencing homelessness. These were all sort of identified as the kinds of people who needed to be targeted and arrested by police in order to keep a neighborhood safe and profitable. Sexual policing was also at the heart of broken windows policing. Broken windows policing provided a ballast, a justification, a legal justification to reintroduce status policing, reintroduce laws that legalized targeting people for presumed sexual practices. So during this period in particular, you see the development of loitering with intent laws. So the idea is that if status policing, just policing someone based on their looks, was illegal now, thanks to the 1972 Supreme Court ruling, they could add an element of intent and say that, you know, a woman was clearly standing on the street corner because she intended to engage in commercial sex. And this is actually what I focus on, how these laws were passed and upheld as constitutional in Atlanta and Georgia, right? And so this, in this way, sexual policing served as a laboratory pointing the way to model how police can expand their powers on city streets, reclaim the authority that had been taken away by liberal judges and legislatures, to reclaim their power to arrest people simply based on how they look on city streets.
So we've been focusing mostly on the 1920s through the 1980s. That was a while ago, although you're certainly pointing to important features of the growth of police power, the expansion of police power, something that, of course, many of us are concerned about even today. What are the main takeaways from this history? What can we learn from what you've recounted? What are the main things we might use today in terms of our activism and our thinking about this subject?
So one key takeaway that I want folks to carry forward is that even though we might think of street-based sex work as a relic of the 20th century, we still live with the outsized police authority to target people based on how they look every day. Right? Even though states like New York and California have struck down laws like the loitering with intent laws, which were enforced with a high degree of discretion, right, which endangered in particular Black women and trans women and poor women across the racial spectrum, we still live with the outgrowth and the consequences of police departments that came to power through sexual policing. Overall, we can see how even though police change how they justify sexual policing, one thing that holds true across the 20th century is that sexual policing does political work. It generates enormous amounts of power and legitimacy for police departments, and that alone is a reason that we should reject it. It also does political work for urban economies. Whether urban authorities were invested in keeping their cities racially segregated or in transforming cities into sites of capital investment and dispossession of poor residents, sexual policing was very clearly and deliberately identified as a strategy to lay the groundwork for gentrification. You know, you have police officers, mayor's offices, and developers, right? Urban developers all talking in very clear terms about the desire and the intention of clearing sexually suspect and sexually profiled women, especially Black women, off city streets in order to make way for the development of, you know, luxury condos, and other sort of affluent white sites of capital. But sexual policing also does an enormous amount of work for police departments by empowering them to determine who is sexually criminal and who is not, right? And it's that kind of sexual criminalization, the ways in which police are still legally empowered to determine based on how someone looks, based on their gender and sexual presentation, whether or not they are punishable, arrestable, right, and jailable, right? And that in itself is a violence to free and autonomous gender and sexual expression. You know, so ultimately, when I started this book, I was a supporter of decriminalization of prostitution laws, which was a demand that was set by the leaders of the sex worker rights movement, you know, since the 1970s. By the time I finished the book, however, I believed that decriminalization was not enough, right? I believed that decriminalizing prostitution-related laws would not be enough because police have consistently shown their shape-shifting capacity to find ways to surveil, target, harass, and arrest people based on their gender and sexual presentation. So really what we need is a full abolition of police regulation of gender and sex presentation, in addition, of course, to the abolition of police themselves. Because what we have seen is that police produce violence against women, police produce and compound the violence that women experience at the hands of non-state actors as well, which is also a piece I talk about in the book, right? The way that police produce violence in women's lives does not make them safer. And so while, of course, when we talk about abolishing police, we need to also think about the gender and sex specific ways in which police need to be abolished. Because ultimately, any law in the books that empowers police to surveil someone based on their gender and sex presentation, that is effectively criminalizing cis womanhood, trans womanhood. That is effectively restricting the gender and sex autonomy, the free expression of gender and sexuality for anyone on city streets. And so if we care about gender and sex autonomy, if we care about the freedom of gender and sexual presentation, then police must be abolished.
Anne Gray Fisher, historian based at the University of Texas at Dallas. We've been talking about her book, The Streets Belong to Us: Sex, Race, and Police Power from Segregation to Gentrification. Anne, thank you very much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, C.S. This is really fun.
And that interview was conducted on July 17th, 2024. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.